I heard a few comments last week that thought maybe I was a little depressing last week. I'm shocked that somebody would accuse me of being pessimistic. We have in our marriage a proper division of labor. Patty's always cheery and positive and Pollyanna. In fact, a lot of her friends call her Patty-Anna. And they try not to call me at all. I have a definition of a pessimist. I consider a pessimist to be an unrequited optimist. And that seems to be the case. Probably have told this joke before, but do you know the difference between a pessimist and an optimist? Good. You're reading the cue cards. An optimist believes this is the best of all possible world, and a pessimist is afraid this is the best of all possible world. And I do have a tendency to sort of fall in that latter one. However, on this particular issue, I'm not pessimistic. Number one, of course, because we have God. And whether everyone in the world disagrees with God's truth, it's objectively true. It doesn't make any difference. Secondly, the evidence is on our side. We've got tremendous amounts of material, and the truth is on our side, and therefore the final appeal to truth outweighs anything that our adversaries might say. It was, as I say, interesting that one of the characteristics of the early church that has been spoken of was that they had the ability to outthink their opponents. And that's because it was foundationally rooted in true. What was true? What was true about Jesus Christ and his revelation? And it was based on facts and argumentation of those facts. And then thirdly, I'm not pessimistic because we're in the best position that we've been since the Enlightenment, in my opinion, to argue for the truth of Christian faith. The evidence keeps amassing on our side. And this, in fact, has shaken up a number of contemporary atheists. Quentin Smith, who you may know or may remember from his debate with William Lane Craig, and they came out with a book together, has lamented publicly in a philosophy journal at how much evangelicals have taken over the field, how much theists have managed to come back. When you look at the history of philosophy in the 20th century, by the middle part of the 20th century, the ruling idea in philosophy was that of the analytical philosophy and the logical positivist. In an analytical philosophy, to speak of God is a meaningless statement. God is a meaningless term. And so Christianity was pretty well shut out of most serious philosophical discussion at that time. The opposite has happened in our own day. Starting in the 60s with some very serious Christian philosophers, there came to be a regained voice for the Christian faith. And those philosophers at that time have trained other generations of philosophers, and now Christians are a major force in the field of philosophy. And Quentin Smith, in his article, argues that this is something that atheists need to take seriously. You know, he's in panic mode. They're taking over our field, and we've got to figure out a way to put a stop to this. One of the headings in his journal article was the justification of most contemporary naturalists, in other words, atheist views, the justification of most contemporary naturalist views is defeated by contemporary theistic arguments that we have the upper hand. So he's calling his people to arms in the same way that I was suggesting we have a call to arms as well, to prepare and get out there and fight. He's saying the Christians are overcoming us in our own field and we need to do something about it. He says, naturalists passively watched as realist versions of theism, most influenced by Plantinga's writings, Alvin Plantinga, the great philosopher from Calvin, he's now at Notre Dame, I believe, influenced by Plantinga's writings, begin to sweep through the philosophical community until today perhaps one quarter or one third of philosophy professors are theists, with most being Orthodox Christians. Here's an atheist's assessment of his field. Although many theists do not work in the area of philosophy of religion, so many of them do work in this area. There are now over five philosophical journals devoted to theism or the philosophy of religion, such as Faith and Philosophy, Religious Studies, International Journal of Philosophy of Religion, Sophia, and Philosophia Christi, etc. Philosophia Christi began in the late 1990s and already is overflowing with submissions from leading philosophers. But in philosophy, it became almost overnight academically respectable to argue for theism, making philosophy a favored field of entry for the most intelligent and talented theists entering academia today. Again, this is our enemy saying we're in trouble here. The brightest and most talented theists are entering this particular field. A count would show that in Oxford University's press for 2000 to 2001 catalog, there are 96 recently published books on the philosophy of religion, 94 advancing theism, and 2 presenting both sides. A switch of 50 years there from not being a meaningful discussion of philosophy at all to really a major influence in the field of study. And I think this is remarkable, and that we have a number of people that are in that line of descent and defending the faith in the academic community, people like William Lane Craig and others that we're familiar with. And it's one of the reasons why we so heartily support Dr. Craig in his work. Talbot program in philosophy of religion and in apologetics has produced so many philosophers that are actually entering state universities and secular colleges as chairs of philosophy departments, which means the influence of Christianity that is willing to reclaim its place in the world will continue to grow and expand, because those people influence people for another 40 years beyond that. So there's reasons to be positive in the philosophical world. I think there's also reasons to be positive in the science world. Some remarkable things have happened in the 20th century and in now the 21st century that are helpful there. First is, of course, science discovery of the Big Bang. That means, for the first time in many, many, many centuries, Christianity is propelled to the front page, because it said there's a beginning to the universe. Unlike most philosophies in the Eastern world or in the materialist West, here's the Bible declaring that the world had a beginning, and sure enough, scientists go out and discover the world had a beginning. Arnold Penzias, the Nobel laureate and the co-discoverer of the Big Bang radiation, that sort of echo of the Big Bang that was left over, had this to say at one point: "The best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the 5 books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole." You're talking, again, not some flaming evangelical Christian here. You're talking a person as a scientist who's recognizing that. Arno Penzias, the physicist Freeman Dyson, has also said that the universe, in some sense, must have known we were coming. And that's the second major area, which deals with teleology, the fact that the world was so finely tuned in the initial stages of creation that had there been even the slightest variation on any of those elements, there would be nothing here. And it's true that atheists look at that and say, well, we wouldn't be here if those things hadn't happened, so that doesn't tell us anything. But in fact, a solid argument can be made, and the conclusion drawn, as Dyson has, that there's a sense at which the universe is finely tuned for human life. And I think that's been a powerful discussion. The reasons for the starkness I presented last week was to be a challenge to you, to defend the faith, to be faithful to our calling. And you got to understand that there's attacks out there and be aware of what they are in order to be able to respond to them. But again, 1 Peter 3:15, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and respect. Jude 1, talking primarily about attacks from within the church, talks about earnestly contending for the faith. That's a very interesting passage, by the way. You should take a look at that. He says, "I long to write you about the salvation that Jesus Christ provided, but I felt instead I had to write you to earnestly contend for the faith once delivered." He's talking in terms of positive, too. I'd rather be positive and talk about the glories of our salvation and what Christ has done for us. But a more pressing matter is that there's attacks going on, and you need to be ready to contend, to fight for the faith. Matthew 10:16, Jesus warned us that "I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves." the idea of using wisdom and the impact of our knowledge and understanding in a strategic way and not just blasting away. People react to challenges in different ways. Some people look at a challenge and they go, oh, it's too hard, I give up. Some people are just indifferent, so what? But I think the smart person and the obedient Christian is motivated by the Word of God and the challenge that it presents to take the gospel to the world around us. And that, I think, is the reason for dwelling so much on some of these movements that are attacking Christianity today. And I hope that would be your response as well, to be motivated rather than to shrug your shoulders or to give up. Let's continue on then with our discussion of some elements, some aspects of the new atheism. As we talked about last week, there is a tendency for them to sort of sneer at us rather than to seriously engage us. And that shows up throughout their argumentation. But there comes with that a sense on their part of arrogance. They don't need to demonstrate their position is so superior that they don't need to stoop to wrestling with serious versions of arguments against their position. Indeed, their purpose is more that of popularizing and proclaiming the atheistic faith than it is in careful argumentation. Dawkins says in his book, "If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. What presumptuous optimism. Of course, dyed-in-the-wool faith heads are immune to argument." Christians are, you know, they're totally faith-oriented, and faith is irrational, that we don't need to actually think that this enterprise is going to affect them at all. He says elsewhere, as you see in your bulletin, the quote by him, "Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps of, the lack of evidence." Harris says in his book, "I've set out to demolish the intellectual and moral pretensions of Christianity in its most committed forms." They're not mincing words about what it is they attempt to do. And of course, we talked last week about the subtitle of one of the books, that religion poisons everything. One of the new atheists, Hitchens, I believe, has a whole chapter in his book on the child abuse of bringing your children up with religious belief, and argues seriously that it's a major form of child abuse that should perhaps require some legal action. They also have, as I said last week, gone Madison Avenue. They've tried to make atheism slick and cool and more public, and therefore they have advocated, I think, more slogans and more pop-level material. Dawkins was one of the ones that contributed heavily to that bus program in England a couple years back, where they had on the side of the buses statements like, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. Again, something that atheism hasn't gotten into before, but looking at the pop culture and how to reach out in slogans instead of serious argumentation. An American parallel to that was the humanist society that had the ads in the New York buses this past Christmas that said, "Why believe in a God? Just be good for goodness sake." Again, kind of interesting that they would pick one of the holy holidays of Christendom to make that attack.
How would they define good either?
Well, that's a whole other topic. They all argue that you can define good apart from God, which is a whole other discussion. But these are more of a sneer than an argument. The assumption is that Christians are so stupid or ignorant that they're dangerous and that they need to be stopped. The solution on our part lies in not being ignorant and untrained. Always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that is in you. I've said this before, and I know it's slightly offensive, but it's meant to be a cage rattler. Too often, Christians give the impression that they're Christians because they just don't know any better. That if only they were more educated and really knew what was going on in the world, they would realize that there's nothing in Christian belief. We've too often replaced our passion and our energy for reasoned argument and good solid reasons and evidence. We cannot expect our passions to replace fact. Proverbs 19:2. It is not good to have zeal without knowledge. It's not that zeal is evil, but by itself, it's problematic. You've got to have it with knowledge. Remember, that's the same accusation that Paul points at the unbelieving Jews in his day in Romans there, where he talks in chapter 10, I can testify about them, speaking of the unbelieving Jews, that they are zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. We also have to make sure in our response that we keep to the other part of the command to be prepared to defend, which is to do this with gentleness and respect. The fact that they are dismissive of us and arrogant towards us doesn't mean that we should return in kind. Our job is to present the material in a winsome and convincing way. And it's too easy for us to stoop to calling them names and poking at them a little bit as well. Not, again, that you can't occasionally point to the irony or absurdity of a particular statement. But our defense has to go beyond that sort of dismissive behavior. Well, what are some of their major arguments? And again, as I said last week, none of these are really new. What's changed is the tenor of their presentation of atheism. The arguments are still pretty much the same. Nothing's developed and changed since the village atheists of the 19th century. But what has changed is the climate. 9/11 said zealous religious adherence can be dangerous. And an unpopular presidency that was identified with Christians means, again, that the shift in climate has allowed for these sort of attacks to come without expecting to be dismissed too easily. But one of their major arguments in all of these cases is that religion is evil. Religion is evil, particularly fundamentalist religions, which they would include not only fundamentalist Islamic religions, but fundamentalist Christians. The argument is that when you look back through human history, the evil of the Inquisition, the Crusades, the pogroms against the Jews, the slavery, apartheid, and every evil in society can be laid at the foot of religious believers. And, of course, that's a bit of a problematic argument. I pointed out a little bit last week. But, first of all, Christianity can be true even though we don't always live up perfectly to it. And so we do have to confess that in the past, Christians haven't always treated other people with the respect that their createdness in the image of God demands. And so we've fallen short there. But the Christian position sort of predicts that. We live in a fallen world, and we're fallen human beings. There's an abnormality to the world as it exists now. When you deal with a naturalistic worldview, you don't have that. Because whatever is right in a naturalistic worldview. So you have no hope of conquering the evil in mankind. You have no reason to expect that there's evil there to conquer. We're all part of nature. Nobody yells at the wolf that eats the rabbit out in the wild. If that's all we are, then it becomes difficult to project any sort of moral order to that. On a atheist view, where on a Christian view, you certainly have that possibility. But Christians have failed at this, and we need to acknowledge it, but also talk about the issue of truth behind all of this. That's an issue of whether we've lived up to that truth. What we are discussing at the level of the atheist-Christian debate is which one is true, and that's a whole different discussion. Many years ago, in the 30s, G.K. Chesterton responded to a journal that had invited essays from people in Britain on what's wrong with the world. And G.K. Chesterton wrote back, and his entire essay was, "I am." And that's the Christian worldview. We're what's wrong with the world. And apart from the grace of God, there's no way out of that. Second, in answer to that, it's not really true, of course, that when you look at the atheist regimes in the 20th century, there are more deaths that occurred in the 20th century through specific political oppression under the communist and variations off of that than all of the ones combined in human history up to that time. One critic has said that these authors failed to take into account the 70 million who died under Chairman Mao, the 20 million who died under Stalin, or the nearly 2 million who no longer exist because of Pol Pot, not to mention those exterminated under Nicolae Ceausescu and Kim Jong-il and others. Should we ask whether the atheism of the 20th century Russia and China influenced their cultures for better or worse? More human deaths and torture in the 20th century atheist cultures than entire history combined. Now, having said that, note that that's a bad argument. You're hardly going to be compelling to say, well, we've killed a few less people than you have, so therefore you ought to believe us. So while we shouldn't let them get away with the fact that Christianity and religion has been murderous in many cases, and that that's not true in terms of testing communism on the same principle or atheism on the same principle, that's not an argument you want to pursue as a question or a truth issue. And the real issue then is which one gives a basis for morality. And one of the reasons why communism was greatly diminished in the 20th century was because a group of French philosophers who generally French philosophers up to that time had been Marxist, started writing books like Bernard-Henri Lévy's Barbarism with a Human Face, arguing that wherever communism has set itself up, it has been oppressive and by nature requires the destruction of people. It doesn't have a proper basis for anything else. And that shifted the philosophical understanding of communism in ways that hadn't been done before. But again, argue on the basis of what's true and what provides an answer to the solution of evil rather than just simply comparing numbers. A second area of argumentation that the new atheists give is that of philosophical arguments. They attempt to argue against the standard arguments, for example, of the existence of God or of the problem of evil. And as I said before, the inroads we've made there are quite significant, thinking of the quote from Quentin Smith earlier, we're near panic in his approach to saying, the Christians are coming, look out, in terms of philosophical discussion. But you'll find that these new atheists, when they deal with the arguments for the existence of God, are dismissive of them. They don't spend a lot of time on them, and in several cases, they misunderstand the argument altogether. There's no serious engagement, for example, with William Lane Craig's version of the Kalam cosmological argument, which has been one of the most effective arguments for the existence of God in the modern age. They tend to either dismiss these things as not worthy of their attention or to argue in a way that misunderstands the argumentation. Here's what Alvin Plantinga says about their discussions in his review of Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. Says Plantinga, "The God delusion, however, contains little science. It's mainly philosophy and theology, or perhaps atheology would be better, would be a better term. The evolutionary psychology, along with a substantial dash of social commentary, decrying religion and its alleged baneful effects. As the above quotation suggests, one shouldn't look to this book for an even-handed or thoughtful commentary. In fact, the proportion of insult, ridicule, mockery, spleen, and vitriol is astounding. Could it be that his mother, while carrying him, was frightened by an Anglican clergyman on the rampage?" If Dawkins ever gets tired of his day job, a promising future awaits him as a writer of political attack ads. Now, despite the fact that this book is mainly philosophy, Dawkins is not a philosopher. He's a biologist. Even taking this into account, however, much of the philosophy he purveys is at best jejune. You might say that some of his forays into philosophy are at best sophomoric, but that would be unfair to sophomores. The fact is, grade inflation aside, many of his arguments would receive a failing grade in a sophomore philosophy class. This, combined with the arrogant, smarter-than-thou tone of the book, can be annoying. I shall put irritation aside, however, and do my best to take Dawkins' main arguments seriously. And so you can see somebody again who is a well-known professional philosopher and looking at this says that these arguments have been dismissed too easily. He even treats some of the popular arguments. Hitchens, I believe, in looking at Lewis's liar, lunatic, or lord trilemma, says he should have known better. That the other possibility is that Jesus was just mistaken. But in fact, that's precisely one of Lewis's arguments, that if you think you're God and you're not, you are insane. And it's not a matter of simple mistake, but it's something that goes beyond that. Classic arguments are things that Christians should know something about. The cosmologic argument attempts to explain why the universe is here in terms of a proof for the existence of God. As Leibniz said in the earlier time, the fundamental problem is why something exists rather than nothing. And again, in our day, because of the understanding of the Big Bang, that the universe did pop into existence at one day, this becomes an interesting pivot point in this discussion. And as I say, the Kalam argument by Bill Craig has developed not only the philosophical argument, but he's applied scientific cosmology to this argument as well. There's the teleological, the argument from design, which has been weakened since Darwin, but there's new attempts to resurrect it in stronger and more dynamic forms. And, of course, there's the ethical proof of God's existence, that any sort of objective ethic must require an ethicist at the divine level, somebody who transcends human existence. And it's interesting that new atheists almost all try and argue that there is an objective morality, but they end up with a morality that's of words only. When you actually push them on that issue, they're terribly deficient at that point. And then finally, the historical argument, and we'll look at the neo-atheist arguments there are very similar to arguments that we're going to look at in the next couple weeks of Bart Ehrman's, and we'll take a look at those. Next, of course, their strong suit is science, and they argue that modern science provides no need for a God. And part of the problem here is their misunderstanding of the relationship between science and religion. They have a false understanding. They say Christianity or religion was invented to explain things that we couldn't explain. But that's not the case with a revelatory religion. If in fact Christianity is true, it's not there to explain things. It's there to reveal God. And so it's quite easy for them to deal with an argumentation of a God of the gaps, but Christianity at its essence doesn't argue the God of the gaps. We don't need God to explain things. God does explain things, but the truth rests on the truth of God and not on explanatory power. They argue that religion is the enemy of science. You know, this sort of myth of the Enlightenment, that there has been this deathlock combat between science and religion, and religion's always impeding science, and science is always triumphing over religion. In fact, that's a particular perspective that can't be backed up by the evidence. Many philosophers of science have argued that science, modern science, can only arise out of a Christian worldview. Unless you believe there's a rational order to the universe that can be unraveled, why would you go out and look for reasons and evidence? And it's not just Christians that have argued this way. You have people like J. Robert Oppenheimer and Alfred North Whitehead and, on a Christian perspective, Stanley Yackey. This is simply not a good portrayal of the relationship between science and religion. However, and listen closely when I say this so that you don't misunderstand what I'm saying, the solution here is for Christians to be better prepared or to shut up. A great stumbling block in belief in God has been some rather, how can I say this charitably, rather less than convincing solutions to problems that have been elevated to central issues in Christianity. Boy, that wasn't very clear, was it?
I'll just say it the way you want to say it.
If Christians are going to be involved in this, then you need more than a grade school education in science or a high school education in science. If you're going to talk and debate science, then, you know your limitations and argue as far as you can and don't extend beyond that. You know, even if you believe that the Earth was created, the universe was created 6,000 years ago in six 24-hour periods of time, do you really want to make that a central doctrine of the Christian faith, that you can't come to Christ unless you believe that? Your understanding of that passage is going to keep someone out of the kingdom? You have to be either silly or arrogant to think that your understanding and interpretation of that passage is going to be the end-all and be-all whether somebody gets into the kingdom. You know, didn't we learn nothing from Galileo? You know, the church pointed at verses like Ecclesiastes 1:5, the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. That obviously the earth doesn't move, it's the sun that moves. And yet we recognize today that that was phenomenological language, the sort of language we use in everyday life. It wasn't meant to be a serious cosmological discussion. You know, think of these people that are out, their demagoguery, saying that this is a central issue of Christianity and that you give up the whole biblical faith unless you hold to this young earth position. You know, when did it become a central issue for any Christian group? You know, do you think it was the church fathers? No, church fathers were quite fine with long periods of time. Maybe up until the time of Darwin. No, nobody ever made it a creedal statement that you have to believe the universe was 6,000 years old, or that you had to understand it in just a specific way in order to be a believer. How about the end of the 19th century and the battles that began brewing over liberals and Christians? Not there either. The great Orthodox defenders of the faith in that period of time, people like Charles Hodge and B.B. Warfield and William Henry Green, none of them held to that view. None of them expected Christians to hold to that view. Maybe it was in the fundamentalist movement of the early 20th century. Not there either. The fundamentals, the multi-volume set of books that launched the fundamentalist movement in the 1910s, 19-teens, had people of both persuasions in that, and in fact there was probably a predominance of people who believed in an old earth creation. So defining fundamentalism didn't include that issue. How about the Scope trials? Surely that did it. You know, no. William Jennings Bryan, on the stand, confessed that the world's a lot older than 6 to 10,000 years old. The fact is that this became sort of a tempest in a teapot in the 1960s, early 1960s, when two guys, John Whitcomb and Henry Morris, wrote a book called The Genesis Flood. And suddenly it became the mark of orthodoxy, if you're a Bible-believing Christian, to believe that the universe is 6 to 12,000 years old. It's interesting that Whitcomb and Morris actually borrowed their material from Seventh-day Adventist writer George McCready, who was writing to justify the prophetess Ellen White, the prophet of Seventh-day Adventism, who argued that the world was created just a short few thousand years ago. And so he tried to marshal evidence to present on a geological framework that would argue for that. And Whitcomb and Morris borrowed heavily from their work in order to present that. You see, our task as evangelists, our task as apologists, is to bring people to Christ. Anything that's not an essential, that's a stumbling block, is off limits. You know, hold the view you want on your own, but don't make it something that turns people off from the Christian faith. Stop pontificating on, you know, your understanding of science based on the limited understanding we probably have. Anyway, I've said enough on that. Psychology is another field, again, that the new atheists talk about. The idea is that if you can explain or give a reason, an explanation for religious belief, then that indicates that religious belief isn't true, which has been a goofy argument ever since it was first put forward in the 19th century by Feuerbach. Feuerbach said, well, mankind needs to be comforted, needs to have somebody warm and caring looking over them. So we extend our view of our parents as protectors to a cosmic parent. And therefore, that explains religious belief. Well, it doesn't disprove religious belief. You know, as one of the other great philosophers of the 19th century, Edward von Hartmann, said, suppose that you're having a bad night and you're tossing and turning, you can't get to sleep, you're in pain, and you long for the morning to come. Does your longing and wishing for the morning to come mean that the morning won't come? You know, even if we have a desire to be comforted and have a cosmic father of some kind, it doesn't disprove that there could be a cosmic father. What you have to do is deal with the evidence, whether there's any evidence for it, not simply arguing that because we have an explanation for how the belief might have arisen, that indicates that there couldn't possibly be anything behind the belief. All of this should urge us on, again, to becoming effective and prepared Christians. We have to have the material at hand, be prepared in the way we've been commanded, and also we've got to be wise in the way we apply that. And again, as I've said, the idea of always being prepared doesn't mean, give it 2 seconds thought and wing it. Always be prepared means you got to put some thought into it ahead of time, some study into it, some work, and also some wisdom how to deal with it. There are resources available in our day that were not available any time in church history before. They're easy to obtain. They range from the very basic level stuff. You can look at Greg Kochel's stuff. You can look at Christian Research Institute, those things that are written on a popular level. And you can go all the way to the highest level of academia. And no one's suggesting that you all have to be PhDs in physics in order to argue. Whether you're a pint jar or a quart jar or a gallon jar, you should be filled. So we have different capacities, but that doesn't mean because you may think that your capacity is smaller. Number one, that's questionable. Perhaps you just haven't exercised your capacity and expanded it. But whatever your capacity should be, you should fill it to the level that you can fill it. And resources are available. It's a question of whether we care enough to reach the world around us or whether we're happy to be Christians ourselves and live in our own little world and hope that things don't get too much worse. But that's hardly a position that's open to us if you're a biblical Christian. You should also support those who work in this field. This is not something that attracts great attention like other areas of mission, foreign missions and medical missions and that sort of thing. Arguing abstract ideas in the university and in academia is not something that excites most people. But the battle's going on at this point, and we need to support the people that are in there fighting those battles for us. And indeed, success can be worked in that field. I've used this illustration before, but many years ago, a friend of mine took a freshman-level philosophy course with the chair of the department out at IU. And he had class on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I met with him on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday and went over the same material from a Christian perspective. And then he would go back in class, not in a disruptive manner, but in a dialogical manner with the professor. And the professor was blown away. For 25 years teaching, he'd had Christians, offer 15 lame brain reasons why his position is wrong and Christianity is true. Things that were so off base that they weren't even worth much serious thought. And suddenly, at a Christian in there wrestling with him, at the level of his philosophy, critiquing his philosophy in a way that his colleagues hadn't in 25 years. And he was so impressed that he invited this student to come talk to the philosophy professors forum and present the Orthodox Christian viewpoint as a real philosophical possibility, because he was astounded. It's funny, at one point he asked him where you learn all this, and he said, in Sunday school. And after the professor got over the heart attack of that idea, the professor's response was, you mean there's more of you? But the problem is we don't take it seriously enough. If we can't win somebody with the four spiritual laws and a two-sentence attack on them, or a two-sentence presentation of the gospel, it's beyond us. We'll let somebody else worry about it, and we don't actually care about their souls that much anyway. The Lordship of Christ demands that we are obedient to him, and we need to be obedient to him in this manner as well. So take it as a challenge and not as a pessimistic view. Next week we'll look at the second grouping of attacks on Christianity, that of those people I've called the new Gnostics. And we'll look at, in particular, at Bart Ehrman's approach as one of the most significant representatives of that approach. So.
Is one foundation is Jesus Christ our Lord. She is his new creation by water and the word. From heaven he came and sought her to be his holy bride. With his own blood he bought her, and for her life he died. She is from every nation, yet one are all the earth. Her charter of salvation, one Lord, one faith, one birth. One holy name she blesses, partakes one holy food, and to one hope she presses with every grace endued. The church shall never perish, her dear Lord to defend, to guide, sustain, and cherish, is with her to the end. Though there be traitor, she ever shall prevail. Though with a scornful wonder men see her sore oppressed, by schisms rent asunder, by heresies distressed, yet saints their watch are keeping, their cry goes up how long. Shall be the more.